This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. In 1948, an unknown nightclub comic duo made its first appearance on a new medium called television. Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis appeared on Toast of the Town, hosted by Ed Sullivan. 2 years later, they were hired as guest hosts on another variety show, the Colgate Comedy Hour, scheduled directly opposite Sullivan. And the combination of Martin's smooth singing and Lewis's manic comedy made them a hit. But they also began conquering films then, and the first volume of the Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis collection, presenting 8 of their early movies, has just been released on DVD. Because of that, and because a recent memoir by Lewis about his years with Martin has just been published in paperback, today we feature Terry's 2005 interview with Jerry Lewis. In between the Ed Sullivan appearance and getting their own star-making TV vehicle, Martin and Lewis appeared on the big screen for the first time as supporting players in My Friend Irma in 1949. Their chemistry was obvious and popular enough for them to get more screen time in and basically steal next year's sequel, called My Friend Irma Goes West. From there, both their film and TV careers skyrocketed. Terry Gross spoke with Jerry Lewis last year when his memoir about his partnership with Dean Martin was published. It was a partnership that began in 1946 and ended 10 years and 16 movies later. The book is called Dean and Me, A Love Story. It's co-written by James Kaplan, who wrote a New Yorker profile of Lewis in the year 2000. Before we get to Terry's conversation with Lewis, let's hear a sample from that new DVD set of My Friend Irma Goes West, the 1950 film essentially featuring them as headliners for the first time. Jerry Lewis is acting as band leader of a nightclub orchestra, and Dean Martin is singing a song, or trying to.
Life is not just in sole pleasure that's so easy to find, but I can find, but I can find.
In the middle you'll find out.
But I can't find life's greatest pleasures in my peace of mind. Give me the road.
Just a little louder. Here we go, fellas. I'll wipe it! And I'm not going to stand here and have you tolerate me.
Where'd you get this band?
What's... Don't yell at the band. I'm leading the band. I'm the conductor, but don't yell at them. That's a union band.
I don't care about you or your union band.
Oh!
See how mad they get? You better say you're sorry.
I will not.
I'm warning you.
No.
Off the stand. All right, there's just a one little mistake. One little mistake? Yeah, you're supposed to overlook it when it happens.
Overlook a mistake?
Sure.
Are you out of your mind?
I'm as normal as you or anyone else. Get off there.
Oh, no, they're not going to take me back. I have the grenades. I've got to mow them all down. I say, may I report, sir? I'd like to try.
Give me the note.
All right. There's one note missing. Give him one note. Big deal. Sing.
Give me the road, the wide, winding highway. Just let me...
You seem like you were so different, not only like on stage and on the screen, but behind the scenes as well. What made you think that there was a partnership here that would work, that what you did and what he did was would work as a duo?
Well, an audience told us that. We went on that first night in Atlantic City, and... it was lightning in a bottle. We had been doing separate acts. I did what they call a dumb act, pantomime to recordings, and Dean did wonderful oldies standard songs. He did his 3 songs. I did my act that ran about 17 minutes. And then before the second show, some of the guys from Atlantic City said, I think you guys better do something together or you're both gone. I had asked them to bring Dean in when the original singer was taken ill, and they said, no, we don't want another singer. I said, but you have to understand, we do things together, you see? You got his act, my act, and then we do silly stuff together. So after that first show together, they came back and said, where's the silly stuff? And we had to prepare it for the second show, or we would have been modeling cement shoes. And we worked the second show for 2 hours and 20 minutes of sheer pandemonium and insanity. And that was how it began.
So you write in the book, with the voice God had given me, I certainly wasn't going to be a singer like my dad with his Al Jolson baritone. I always saw humor in things, the joke possibilities. At the same time, I didn't have the confidence to stand on stage and talk. So how did you figure out what your voice was going to be? Because I don't know how you were when you first teamed up with Dean Martin, but in a lot of your movies together, you have that like high nasal, squeaky kind of voice, which obviously is not your natural speaking voice.
Well, it is when I get excited. When I get really excited, it goes up there. I made a call from Paris. I had a dinner date at Buckingham Palace with Princess Margaret some years ago. And I called the operator at the hotel in Paris. Could you please get this call through to me? I gave her the number. She says, and who is calling? I said, this is Jerry Lewis. And she said, no. I know Jerry Lewis. No. I said, yes, it is, ma'am. Let me put it to you this way. I need you to help me get this call to London. Oh, Monsieur Louis. And she connected me.
So how did you start speaking in that voice on stage?
I always spoke in that voice. I got excited, and I was doing very broad, very physical comedy, which needs the kind of sound effects that my voice gave it. And you do that long enough, and it becomes a wonderful prop or a tool. That's why I rarely do radio, because nobody knows who's talking. And until I get the voice up, oh, I'm glad to be on public radio here. On Fresh Air, it's such a pleasure. They'll know who that is.
Do you think there's a slight Yiddish inflection to that voice?
Of course. Absolutely. I am through and through all Jew, one of the great escapees from Israel. That's me.
No, it's funny, like during the years that you were with Dean Martin was always so solidly identified as Italian. He recorded Italian songs. Italian was part of his persona. You were obviously Jewish, but Jewish wasn't part of your on-screen persona.
No, but it was there. It was hardly possible to miss it because the very essence of what I did as a physical clown came from all of the years of degradation and whatever else we went through before we got our state. It's very important that it's there because it's not something I can get rid of. And I found that it was very acceptable by audiences. They liked to know that the two of us had this wonderful, loyal feeling about our upbringing, where we came from.
Before you started playing in the big clubs and, you know, before you met Dean Martin, you did some work in the Catskills and the Borscht Belt. You performed, you were a tumbler there, and the tumbler is kind of like with like the entertainment director who gets everybody doing Simon Says by the pool and everything. What was your tumbler routine like?
Well, I just destroyed everything that was normal. If chairs were facing the pool, you take a quick turnaround, and now they're facing the other way. I was the towel boy at the pool. I was a bus boy in the afternoon. I served tea at 4 o'clock. My dad and my mom performed for this audience. They did 4 shows a week, and my dad had a repertory company. And in order for me to function and be with my mom and dad, they wouldn't pay for me as part of the repertory company. So I worked as a bus boy. Either that or a towel boy or a tea boy. But I made probably more money than anyone on the entire staff because I entertained everyone that I was dealing with. If somebody needed a towel, I'd do 4 or 5 minutes delivering it, and they loved it. And I got a tremendous, tremendous amount of experience doing that. See, today, the young comics, unfortunately, have nowhere to go and be bad. We had the Borscht Circuit, the Catskill Mountains. We had Lakewood, New Jersey. We had vaudeville, burlesque. My God. There used to be one-nighters on Times Square just at the Astor Hotel and down a ways from Times Square, wherever the hotel was that Chuck Foster played. And I mean, there were so many places for you to be bad. Today, kids don't have a hell of a chance. You know, the only thing they have is maybe if they're chosen for a television sitcom and they see there's a wonderful comic potential, they'll groom them and help them. But that's very rare.
Now, Dean Martin wasn't just a straight man, but in, you know, but he among other things was your straight man. What are some of the things that made him so good at it, and what does it do for you as the comic to have a straight man who's good?
Well, let's put it this way, Terry. I had a straight man that was the best that ever lived. His ability, let's put it this way. He knew when I was going to breathe. He knew when I was doing something that I wasn't really having fun at, and he watched me until he jumped in and saved me from a place I didn't want to be. How did he know that? I mean, I'm talking about the second or third night that we ever performed together. He knew when I was going to take a breath. It was an incredible relationship based on, my God, a comic is seeing someone else understand his beats and his rhythms. It's very rare in this life. And I had 10 magnificent theatrical years because he was brilliant at what he did. He was the most underrated performer ever in our business. And the book for me is not so much doing penance, but I think of it as justice is done, the truth about the magnificent ability that he had to make me funny and to do what we did expertly. And no one ever rated him other than just a relaxed singer. I can show you material and show you things he did that are so spectacular and so soft and light and an unbridled, powerful mental condition to evaluate what we're doing, then do it, and then acknowledge it. The clip that would show you my partner's marvelous ability to do a dramatic scene would be in The Stooge when he gets very drunk in the story, and he and the kid really get into a trauma-like element that busted them up, and it was kind of ironic. What happened in The Stooge, we played that scene in real life only 8 years later.
Well, let's hear the scene from the film. This is Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
Well, what's the matter with you?
Oh, nothing.
Come on. What is it?
I don't know if I should say it.
Go ahead and say it.
What are you going to do about Mary, Bill?
Got any ideas?
No. Except I don't think you ought to let her go away.
It's a free country, isn't it?
Sure, Bill. But she loves you, and if there's something wrong, I think you ought to go to her and try and straighten it out. Maybe it's none of my business.
That's right. It's none of your business.
Yeah, maybe it's not.
So shut up. You know, I think you had a lot to do with Mary leaving me.
I don't say that, Bill.
All that stuff about anything I do is okay with you. I knock my brains out trying to make something of myself. And you with your checkered suit. And what do I get for it?
You're talking crazy, Bill. You shouldn't be thinking that way. I don't like to hear it.
You don't like it? Well, that's tough. I don't like it. I'm sick and tired of looking at you anyway.
That's Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis in a scene from The Stooge. Jerry Lewis is my guest. He has a new memoir called Dean and Me. What did he do exactly in that scene that amazes you?
He's playing one of the most difficult things to play, and that's the drunk who would prefer you didn't know he was. That's a tough scene to play for any actor. And for a novice, this was only our fourth film, and he handled it incredibly good. Our director, Norman Turok, had been around the block a number of times and had directed magnificent films such as Boys Town, working with Spencer Tracy and Mickey Rooney. So he was a very credible director who told me after it was all over he did not believe that Dean had only made four films. He was so brilliant.
As you pointed out, so Dean Martin was the suave, cool one on stage, sophisticated, and you were the, quote, the monkey. You were this kind of like post-adolescent, energetic.
You have to put the dramatic emphasis on monkey. That was on the stage
exactly.
When being paid.
Yeah. You're
not going to get the monkey for free, kid.
No. But here's what I'm asking. Offstage.
Yeah, yes.
Did those onstage characters ever interfere with your offstage relationship with Dean Martin? Did he ever expect that offstage you weren't going to be very bright, or that offstage he would be able to be the sophisticated one and you not? Because let's face it, you are very bright. You obviously have a lot of showbiz smarts too. You knew a lot about contracts and all of that stuff. So was there ever any confusion about those onstage and offstage personalities?
No. When I walked off stage, Dean knew full well that I would handle everything relative to our act and our performances better than anyone. He respected what I knew about our craft, and he always bowed to me, or he would tell anyone and everyone, you have to talk to Jerry about that, or he handles that, or he'll get into it with you. But on the stage, it was a banana, a monkey, and anything else you want. The house number didn't mean anything. I did what I had to do, and it was a marvelous tool for me for when I had to negotiate an important deal with people who think they got the monkey in their office, and they find out, wait a minute, this guy's got 168 IQ. That's hardly a chimp. And we walk out of there with the kind of negotiation that I believe we were entitled to.
What was it like to translate the partnership you had in nightclubs into characters that could sustain themselves in movies with plots? Like you say in the book that when you first met with Hal Wallace, who produced the Martin and Lewis movies, that you pointed out that Dean Martin could play any role, but you basically had to play the Jerry character. Otherwise, it just wouldn't work. So can you talk a little bit about translating the club act into movies?
Well, there was no way that could be done. You cannot transfer feelings. Now, the feelings in a nightclub that you get from the performers who are projecting specific feelings during the performance, you cannot take that and bottle it or ship it or package it. It's something that happens specifically in a nightclub, and when you attempt to bring it to another form or another format, it just doesn't work, and it never did. So that we had to take the characters and attach them to whatever we were playing in film. And it worked. Dean was Dean in his performances and nightclubs, in every media. And when it came to film, it was still Dean. We never allowed, in the writing process, we never allowed him to be muscled or his space taken with an idea that might look different. No, you can't do that. And more important than anything else, the love the two men had for one another would come through. And you can't get that with any two people.
Exactly that. The love that you two had for each other. But at some point, you kind of fell out of love. And things started to not go so well.
Wrong. Yeah. Wrong.
Okay,
We never, ever fell out of love. All we did was get caught up in people around us that felt it was necessary to divide us. I'll give you an example. One guy says, did you take a bath this morning? And the other guy says, why? Is there one missing? Okay, that is a burlesque joke from circa 1900. And the two men that played that joke one night, I turned to Dean and said, and we're getting $11 million next year? They weren't paying us for that joke or any others like it. They were paying for two men to let an audience see how much fun they were having and the love that went on between the older guy and the younger guy. When we were able to project that to an audience, we had them in our pockets from day one.
You were about 9 years apart?
Yeah, we were just about 9 years, right. Yeah, I was 20, he was 29 when we really started to move.
But by the time you got to the end of the Martin and Lewis movies, from all I've read, you weren't talking outside of the scenes.
No. That was one movie.
Hollywood or Bust?
Yeah, that was the last movie. The last 10 months of our relationship, we never spoke. And in that 10 months, we did the end of one film, which was Pardners, and then we went into the Hollywood or Bust film. We did not talk at all.
How do you make a comedy with somebody who you're not even talking to on the set?
It's easy. When you turn your professionalism into a mechanic, if you can then deal with it technically, you deliver the body, you deliver the feet in the marks that they give you, and you learn the words and you say them, hopefully, without bumping into the furniture.
If you think
and
that
that's what we...
I'm sorry.
That's what we had to do. We had to work as mechanics, and we did it. We got through it. An audience didn't know we weren't talking. We were both very professional about the problem, and we dealt with it.
Jerry Lewis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, very much.
Jerry Lewis, speaking to Terry Gross in 2005.